Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history.
International discussions have essentially taken place now for almost two decades. And we have very little to show for it other than an increase, acceleration, of the climate change phenomenon. The time for talk is over.
I'm at the front now. Camera crews being pushed back by the police, the policing fairly disorganized, jagged lines of officers not quite sure what to do. Protesters seem to be pushing through, now they're forcing us back a bit. A couple, they've all got their batons out actually. Officers are pulling people off vans, they're throwing girls on the floor. It's getting very aggressive. One protester has been hit by pepper spray, and he looks fairly composed, but just he's just not stopping crying, and he keeps on clutching his head, can't open his eyes. Horrible stuff. The demonstration has been announced illegal, and therefore the delegates from inside the Bella Center who are trying to come out and join us are being arrested as they leave. Apparently some are still persevering and trying to link up with us. We're not inside the compound, but we're next to a van that's got a speaker system in it, and we're holding it up against the police. The police have a line that runs from the front of the van and curves round to the entrance, and behind the van there are many people dancing and singing. It's very peaceful, and people just want to see the right thing happen. Okay, so there's one brilliant action there where they've lashed a load of inflatable mattresses together and made a pontoon that stretches across the ditch. It was kind of like a small river into the Bella Center. It looks like a couple of people got by and they were arrested straight away, so again, efforts to have a people's assembly closed down.
We haven't got a clue. Basically, I was in the Naomi Klein chat, like talk for ages, and it was amazing. It was absolutely mind-blowing, changed my life. And then, right, the party started, and there was just brilliant scene after brilliant scene, and around about 10 o'clock, half past 10, there was an announcement to say there's riots happening, there's tear gas, the wind's blowing the tear gas, you might smell it a little bit. I had to put my head outside the tent to use the phone. I definitely got tear gas. There was just police, helicopters and people. I could see a few people scattering in amongst the trees. But I couldn't really see. I couldn't really tell what was going on. And then basically the music stopped. What time are we now? Is it midnight?
One voice, one position. Nigeria, one voice, one position. Liberia, one voice, one position. Ghana, one voice, one position. Sierra Leone, one voice, one position. Togo, one voice, one position. Africa, one voice, one position. Africa, one voice, one position. Cameroon, one voice, one position. Egypt, one voice, one position. Ghana, one voice, one position. One African, one voice, one position. One voice, one position. Indonesia, one African, one voice, one position. One voice, one position. African Union. a politically binding deal which is being pushed by Nicolas Sarkozy, hiding behind African ends of states, to us is very unfair, and we are not going to allow Africa to be divided by some industrialized countries. That is our position, and we stand here to condemn that with the strongest terms possible. So I think the global community is standing by us. The moon, you can see, is that all of us, the African group, all other groups, the G77, are for a legally binding deal. We want an outcome which is a two-track outcome, and there is nothing less than that. And that is our stand up to now. We know it is a very trying moment for us. We know there are a lot of manipulations going around. We know there are a lot of cult dangling going around, but that should not be accepted at all.
Can I clarify? You were making some allegation that Sarkozy was trying to split the African group.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me why you say that?
Yeah, the statement he issued with the Ethiopian head of state was not sanctioned by the Conference of Africans and of States. So that bilateral engagement is what we are opposing. Because if we want to oppose Africa, let him come through the structures which are there. We know it is not only Sarkozy alone, but there are many others, industrial, is part of that industrialized countries who are bent on breaking the G77, and they are using any other means, and that is part of it.
Could you tell me how many countries are currently supporting this proposal here at the UN talks?
Well, actually, in the shared vision, the position of Mother Earth rights is supported by G77 and China.
And what about the issue of climate debt specifically?
The same. Climate debt is an issue that now is supported and with a lot of effort and energy from G77 plus China.
So it's now the official position of the 135 or whatever it is countries that make up the G77 China bloc?
Now, it began as a position of Bolivia, but now in the last submissions that have been put on the table just a couple of days, all the countries said, we're going to support you on that.
Wow, that's the first offer. That's fantastic news. And the level of support amongst civil society for this proposal?
Oh, it's growing and growing. In civil society, I would say that ordinary people that think in life and not only in their pockets, they realize that all this problem is because we have break the balance with nature. And if we want to solve this problem, we must have a new paradigm of living in harmony with our Mother Earth. So I would say, and as you can see in the different social events of social movements, that there is a great support growing for this proposal.
You know, some countries have done all right. I mean, I have to say the UK government hasn't been at all bad, but the European Union's disappeared off the face of the earth. During the Kyoto talks in 1997, it was the EU which was really pushing it. This time they're nowhere to be seen. What's going on? The real hero of the talks seems to be Lumumba Diaping, the Sudanese delegate, who has really pushed the wealthy nations to pay attention to what the science is saying. And it's pretty ironic that it takes someone from one of the poorest nations on earth to tell the rich nations who commissioned most of the science themselves and have paid for most of the science to tell them what the science actually says.
So do you think that your view of the COP process has changed during this last couple of weeks? Were you more hopeful at the start?
Well, I was never bursting with optimism about it because I knew what the constraints were, not least the fact that hanging over everything is the fact that the US Senate hasn't made a decision yet and is unlikely to make a decision which in any way reflects the gravity of the situation. And until the Senate sings, everything else is a dead letter, really. But I have to say, even my fairly gloomy outlook doesn't match the full scale of the uselessness of those cretins who are so far utterly failing to produce anything resembling a sensible agreement.
Do you think it's time for a whole new political process?
Yeah, I do. And I think one of the things that's very striking to me is how little has changed in 150 years. The faces around the table are different. There's people from many more countries of the world than the old negotiations where the European powers took a map of the world and drew lines across it and divided it up between them. But there's simply no engagement with people outside those national governments. It's just not happening. There's no process by which the people can feed their views into the process. And you know, we've got to move on from this model where national governments who are elected for totally different reasons than the negotiations taking place here assume a mandate to speak on behalf of all the people of the world without any reference to the people of the world. And that is one of the things that has to change. The process is corrupt. It's exclusive. There is a complete wall between those who claim to represent us and the people. And it's hardly surprising, really, that it's produced so far nothing of substance.
Indeed. But do you think that it's very difficult for governments to have any kind of public participation when actually a lot of the policies that they might propose may be very unpopular?
Well, that is definitely one of the problems. And you know, some governments, including the UK, as it has to be said, you know, I'm no champion of the UK government normally, but it is ahead of the people. Unfortunately, you know, you'd like to believe that it's a people pushing the government, but in this case, it's a government pulling the people. And it's saying we are taking a relatively firm position on climate change. It doesn't go far enough, but a relatively good position on climate change because we believe this is the right thing to do and this is what our scientific advisors are telling us we ought to do. But it's not that we don't see that massive groundswell of popular opinion saying these are the climate policies we want, deliver or else we'll boot you out at the next election. That's just not happening. And it's a real shame. You know, we should be seeing hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. This is, after all, the most important meeting that's ever taken place, or it should have been, because it's about the most important issue. It's about the biggest challenge humankind has ever faced. So where is everyone?
Supposing that it does all collapse and nothing good comes out of it, or a very weak deal comes out of it, how do we galvanise civil society and the public to actually gather their energy together and focus on the issue once again? Because isn't there a risk that people will just forget about it and see it all as a complete waste of time after this?
Well, that's a real danger, that once the excitement's over and the red carpets have been rolled up and the cutlery's all been cleared away, then people kind of forget about it and you know, it loses momentum, the talks lose their thrust. And I believe that those people who are really committed to seeing action taken on climate change, we must get much more confrontational. And I want to see a series of big confrontational direct actions, non-violent direct actions across the world against the most carbon-intensive industries, against coal mines, against tar sands, against oil refineries, against the banks and investors making these things happen. We need to see people thrusting this much more into the public mind, and you do that by taking action rather than just by saying things.
We were left today by 7:30 this morning on the train. The police spotted us, and we had ropes around us and quite a lot of gear actually, like wire cars and stuff. But anyway, so we ended up in the cells by 8 o'clock. Well, because everyone was such high energy and a lot of people got lifted really early, it all kicked off. We broke down a couple of the cell walls.
Were these the cages that we've cages heard about?
Okay. Very Glendano Baysdale, and it was just a warehouse of cells, so like, I know there's meant to be 1,500 in it, but you could only see so much of the cells. I don't think it was that much. But just because everyone was so riled up, there was a lot of chanting, a lot of bashing against the cages. Yeah.
People were quite often making like animal noises. But we had people within the group that were clowns that had been arrested, and they were trying to do clowning inside. There were people doing yoga inside. We rolled our socks into balls and started playing games with them, like football and volleyball and things. And there was just a kind of spirit of we are not caged animals, and it led to these things like us ripping
whereby we worked out if you get enough people on the dividing cages between the cells, you can lift it up and bend it out of the cage and then get everybody into one cell. So we the first time we did this, it's great because it just cheering goes up around the place, like everyone's going mental on the other side of the place, they know we've got a cage up. But just like 100, well, I don't know, about 40 cops just filled the corridor.
And then they start pepper spraying, and it's really, really vicious stuff. And when everyone is on the ground and at the back, they start to come in with the truncheons, and they just, we linked arms, but they just beat us until, and pressure pointed us until they could get one person out. And then they'd come in again and do the same and get another person out, and one by one, and put us in another set of cells. And then finally, when they'd gone away and enough chanting and energy built up again, we'd do the same thing. And then they'd do it again, and they'd come in and beat us up and drag us away. And then eventually we got zip ties put on in the cages behind our backs. And then we started undoing, we came up with a way of undoing the zip ties. And they came in, and then dead people zip ties people's hands behind their back, and then zip tied it to their belt buckles.
I think it was important to keep up some sort of fight, as you know, we got lifted at fucking 7:30 in the morning. A lot of the bike people were lifted well early as well. It's, if we can't do shit outside, then we'll nice things up in here. The level of repression is just absolutely unreal. Like, they're arresting people for having done nothing. We're on the way to the protest. They can hold you for 12 hours. Like, it's just a complete lack of human rights. So it was important to, take out as much police time as we could with damaging yourselves, but also show that we're not going to just sit back and not fight.
Some of the people that had been targeted were medics. We had a friend who is a medic who had been arrested 3 times during the week and had been in these cages before, and was just so frustrated. And someone had been beaten by the police and had got a nasty head injury, and they're being treated by a medic. And
were you being treated by police medics or by medics who'd been arrested?
This was at a protest outside.
This was at a protest outside.
When it was just as he was about to get lifted, and they were treating this person, and the police came in, and although they were going to take them to hospital, the police just arrested them. And this person was feeling quite sick, and after a bad head injury, that's usually a sign of severe concussion. And the police were leaving this person in a cage where they could have like fallen into a coma. It's really, really nasty.
Yes, that was the sound of someone snoring. It's 6:30 a.m. Nope, sorry, it's 10 to 7, and I am surrounded by sleeping journalists, and still the negotiations are going on. There are 20 more people on the list for this round of speaking, and I presume there's going to be replies after that. I didn't make it to my hotel tonight. I'm very sad about that because I haven't seen the inside of my hotel, and I was really excited about staying there. I have to check out tomorrow because there's no space tomorrow night, and I don't know if it's even worth getting another hotel because nobody's going home from this place. We're here all the time. And these talks don't look like they're finished, not by a long way. Unless something dramatic happens in the next couple of hours, which you never know. It wasn't Phil snoring, but I've just come back to the desk and he is now asleep. Aww.
It's fairly incredible how this many people, so few people, can hold up against helicopters and police vans and batons and pepper spray. And it's an incredible effort and people just aren't giving up. They're forming chains around areas that they think are going to help facilitate the people's assembly. although it seems like the Danish government is doing everything it can to inhibit a democratic and free discussion of the problems that should be discussed inside the Bella Centre, they're doing this because they believe in it, and they'll do whatever it takes to get their voice heard.
The right to demonstrate is the basic need of people living together, and this basic need has been destroyed by the policemen.
We are green, we are red, we are black. We have come to take the power back. We are black, we are green, we are red. We remember what cancer was said, Lord, take my soul, the struggle continues, even if we're nursing the no-deal blues. Sub-Zero carnivals have always been my thing. My cozy pink and silver dancing boots I'll be sure to bring. On a pyre of profit, my future they want to fling. But into being such sweet songs, our street souls will sing. Street souls will sing. Black, we are red, we are green. But can we crystallize that which we dream? We dream of oceans unrisen and our friends out of prison and a hurricane of climate justice blowing and of human kindness overflowing. I think it's gonna rain today. Sub-Zero carnivals have always been my thing. My cozy pink and silver dancing boots I'll be sure to bring. With possibility our movements crackle and sing. We have brought the righteous rhythms to make those movements swing. Make the movements swing. Reclaimed our hope, but we come back with some seeds and some good ideas and some stories and some myths to tell. Watch me. We're gonna bring him back, gonna bring him back and put him down. Come on back and put him down. Build him up, build him up. Bring it back, yeah, bring him back and build him up. Yeah, build it up. Bring it back, yeah, and bring it back and build it up. Ooh. Bring it back and build it up.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's no time to waste. America's made our choice. We have charted our course. We have made our commitments. We will do what we say.
This document threatens the lives and the livelihoods of millions of people in developing countries and the existence of the African continent and her people. You have relentlessly and single-mindedly decided to advance through this document with the circle of commitment and those who have agreed, the heads of states and heads of government behind this document, to accept a solution that is based on a 2 degrees Celsius, which will result in gross violation of the right to existence of the African and the African continent. L9 is murderous. It condemns and tunnels Africa into a furnace, because 2 degrees Celsius results into 3.5 degrees. According to IPCC AR4 regional report, working group number 2, L9 asks Africa to sign a suicide pact, an incineration pact, in order to maintain the economic dominance of few countries. L9 is devoid of any sense of responsibility, morality, and it is a solution based on values, the same very values, in our opinion, that tunneled 6 million people in Europe into furnaces. Mr. Prime Minister, no Obama, or yourself can force Africa to destroy herself. And I want to say this on record. There's nobody, no African president or prime minister has been mandated or given a mandate to destroy or aid and abet in destroying Africa.
So I'm here with Adrian Bebb, a coordinator of Frontier's Food and Farming Campaign. And there's a whole raft of discussions right now on deforestation in relation to the United Nations climate talks. The demand side of the equation isn't in the draft text, as I understand it, in any operational sense. And yet, people like the Ecosystems Climate Alliance have been saying red won't work unless the demand side, Western consumption of forest-related goods and or the land that is required for those goods that comes from forests is dealt with. So perhaps we can deal with those two aspects. Can you say what kind of impacts Europe's consumption of biofuels and heavily kind of meat-intensive diets is having on the forest, what the link is?
Well, it's quite clear that the way we reduce food and the way we farm land and also for new biofuels, which is a new issue, is having a huge impact on the climate. And if you just take one sector, the livestock sector, then the estimates are that, you know, it's the same emissions as all the cars and lorries in the world. So we're talking about huge impacts. And, you know, agricultural land covers a third of all the land in the planet. So any agreement here has got to take agriculture into account.
What do you think are the solutions for curbing demand of those two big drivers?
Well, we've got to look for a start at the meat consumption. Meat consumption in northern countries is already leading to unhealthy society, and that's quite clear message coming from health professionals. And what we're seeing now is also that it's causing huge climate problems as well. So we're going to have to tackle the overconsumption of meat and dairy products in northern countries. Some of that could come from these negotiations here. That could send a very strong signal of what's needed over the next 10 to 15 years. And also we need to look at biofuels, as it's quite clear another area which could be contributing to climate change. And we want to see there a pulling back of the targets which have been set into stone by, you know, areas like the European Union and also America.
Okay. There's a review, I understand, in relation to biofuels in Europe. How quickly is that going to turn around, do you think, and is there an opportunity to get a moratorium in view of the, you know, some of the science which is now saying that biofuels are actually causing more emissions when you look at the total land use picture than perhaps even fossil fuels? There's strong new evidence base there that would suggest a moratorium could be a good solution?
Well, it's quite clear the science around biofuels is evolving very, very fast. And even though legislation was set only last year, what we're seeing now is that most of the biofuels are worse for the planet than they are for any benefit. What we need to do is have a look at this new research, which is coming out now, and review these targets and stop creating a new market for a product which is going to actually create more damage to the planet than fossil fuels itself.
In terms of curbing demand of Western consumption of meat, what kind of scale of dietary change do you think is necessary, and how do you go about bringing that about? You can't presumably just rely on warm messages coming from Friends of the Earth or whatever to try and convince people for this to happen. Is there an opportunity in reforming the Common Agricultural Policy, which I believe there's a review of as well coming up?
It's quite clear that we're going to have quite major lifestyle changes if we're going to avert the worst cases of climate change. And one of those areas is meat consumption and dairy consumption. And research from Friends of the Earth shows that we need to reduce that by about 60%. We're not saying that people don't eat meat and they don't drink milk or eat cheese or whatever, but we have to quite clearly make some changes if we want to avert climate change. So there's plenty of opportunities coming up, and in particular that there's going to be a major reform, one of the biggest reforms ever, of the Common Agriculture Policy. This is where all the money is given out to farming, and this at the moment is creating a system which is bad for climate change. And what we need to do is actually change it into a system which is good for climate change, and it allows public to have a wider choice, but it also supports small-scale farming, it supports more ecological farming, and it's creating a farming system which is, at the end of the day, is going to help us solve the problems of climate change instead of creating more problems.
Perhaps you can just clarify the connection between consumption of meat in Europe and deforestation in the Amazon. I mean, what is the link there?
Well, the way we produce meat and dairy products is mainly through intensive farming here in Europe, mainly in factory farms, which are growing and growing across especially Eastern Europe. And these animals need feeding, and this feed comes in the form of soy, which is being planted in South America. And to cope with the increase in meat and dairy consumption and the increase in factory farms, we have to grow more and more soy. And what we're seeing is a massive increase in farming in Latin America, which means deforesting areas like the Amazon, and this is leading to massive climate emissions. And all this is being converted to land to grow soy, which is then shipped across to Europe to feed our factory farms. And this is the link we need to change, and this is why we need to challenge things like the agriculture policies of Europe, and also to bring the agriculture into negotiations here in Copenhagen.
You hear some people, I think even the UN's Livestock's Long Shadow report, one of their kind of solutions seemed to be more intensification of the livestock industry. What do you make of that approach?
Well, the way we produce meat and dairy at the moment is a complete failure. It's not only a failure in terms of the climate change, but it's also causing huge amounts of pollution. It's bad for farmers. You're talking about big agribusiness taking over the whole food chain. And this is the thing that's got to change, because it's quite clear we can't carry on as we were before. And I think, you know, the research is showing that livestock is one of the major contributors to climate change, and there's solutions out there. The solution out there is changing agricultural policy, that we actually support much more smaller scale farming, which is much more people friendly, farmer friendly. It's better for the environment and it's better for the climate.
Okay. What's your name?
I'm Deborah.
Phil.
Nick.
Jamie.
So first of all, what are you guys looking forward to this week?
I'm really looking forward to meeting loads of activists from all over the world and finding out what they're up to, and hopefully making some plans, just getting a feel for what people are intending to do over the next couple of years. I don't think that what's going to go on inside the conference is going to be particularly interesting. I don't think it's going to achieve very much.
How about you, Nick? Are you looking forward to it?
Kind of like much the same, really. I've only really just started being involved in climate camp and protest, and I think the whole networking thing is something that I'm really looking forward to, kind of getting more of a feel for what the rest of Europe and the rest of the world, like what the movement's doing. And really interesting, it's like the first really major kind of like protest action type thing that I've been on, so it's quite exciting from that point of view.
How about you? You look a bit more like an old hand.
I'm actually quite a new hand. I'm a video maker, calloused. I'm just coming because I'm really interested to cover what is quite an important, it's almost like probably the most important turning point in my life, maybe politically, where the world can actually try and sort itself out, or whether we're just going to slide down the climate disaster slope. I'm also really interested to see how the kind of activists are using the internet to coordinate their actions, and also to see what are the different techniques that people from other countries use.
That's really interesting. I guess a big part of why the climate camp people here is for protest and direct action. How do you feel about that side of things? Do you think that there's a real opportunity to influence the outcomes of the conference?
I think that my attitude to it might be a bit different to some other people from climate camp. Like, I feel quite strongly that unless the G77 or the African countries group walk out, that we shouldn't be trying to disrupt the talks, because you know, they want the UN. They want the UN to be the body that is managing this problem, because what they're really terrified of is that it's going to be the WTO, the World Bank, which is managing this problem. And you know, like the UN, yes, like it's got these massive problems in it, but a lot of those problems are actually just to do with the simple idea of trying to get everyone talking to each other, which I think is a good idea and a good principle. And yeah, it's really difficult, but unless, like, it's very, very possible that they will walk out. And if they do, then I think that we have every right to be like, this conference does not have a mandate, it doesn't have a platform, and we, the activists here, are representative. We're helping to represent the people that have walked out. But unless if they don't walk out, I don't see how we're more representative than they are.
I certainly agree with that, in a way that, personally, I feel that I try and imagine what a conference like this would be like without any protests, and that to me seems like it would be a complete mistake for this to go unnoticed and just allow our leaders to make the decisions on our behalf without showing that we care about it. Is this something that you feel, that protest has a powerful role to play in this sense?
Yeah, I mean, protest can be a really positive thing, and like you were saying, climate camp isn't just a load of people coming and saying no to things. Like, you know, we've recently in a national gathering, like, come up with basically an initiative where we all have to kind of work in a kind of more social context, working at grassroots community groups and trying to work in that kind of way, in a positive, constructive way, from the bottom up, which is something that we perhaps haven't done so much. We've done individually, but not perhaps as climate camp before.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our news conference. I'm Nick Burning. I work with Friends of the Earth US. There have been a lot of questions about whether it's actually possible to reduce emissions at the rate that both science and justice demand. And today we're here to discuss a report that says the answer is yes. The report is called Europe's Share of the Climate Challenge. And we're going to discuss both the detailed policy analysis, and then we also have a summary report with some policy recommendations. And both documents will be available afterward if you'd like. We have three distinguished panelists. The first is Charlie Heaps. He is the senior scientist at the Stockholm Environmental Institute and is the lead author of the report. He's going to talk about the findings and some of the specific policies that will be needed. Sonia Meister is coordinator of the Climate Justice and Energy Campaign at Friends of the Earth Europe. And in that capacity, she works on generating strong policy at the European Union level. She's going to talk about the implications of the report for European policy. Our third panelist is Nemo Bassi. He is chair of Friends of the Earth International. He is also head of Environmental Rights Action, which is a group in Nigeria. And he's going to put the report into a global context and discuss what it means at these negotiations. So we can go ahead and get started. I'll turn it over to Charlie.
Thanks very much. So what I'd like to do is just try and give you a very brief overview of some of the main methodology or the approaches used in the report. If you do want to see more detail, I do encourage you all to pick up a copy of it because, you know, most of the detailed numbers are available here in the report. So our study really has sort of two main parts to it. It examines how Europe can show climate leadership, both by undertaking domestic actions to rapidly reduce emissions, and also by fulfilling its international obligations to help developing countries address the crises of development and climate change. We start very much from the point of view of what the science says needs to be done, and this chart here shows you a couple of sort of key trends. So one thing you can see at the top line, the orange line, is a 2 degrees C emergency pathway. It's the kind of pathway in greenhouse gas emissions that's going to be required to keep climate change within safe limits, within 2 degrees C. So that's kind of like the bottom line that the globe as a whole has to stay within. If we think about Annex 1 countries and think about very aggressive reductions in Annex 1 countries, and then subtract that from the 2 degrees pathway, you can see that by subtraction, what's left is the pathway for non-Annex 1 countries. So you can see that even with extremely aggressive reductions in Annex 1 countries, there really is not a whole lot of space left for developing countries to continue to develop and to meet their development aspirations within the overall climate budget that science says is left to us. So, and that's the starting point for this report. You know, we've started by thinking about what is that budget available to Annex 1 countries. So in terms of international obligations, we also look at Europe's overall international obligations for assisting the developing world to make a transition to a low greenhouse gas future. So the overall approach that we've used it comes from the Greenhouse Development Rights Framework, which is a basis for thinking about fair contributions to the overall climate burden-sharing effort. That report is also available from SEI. You can see the cover of it there, or you can download it from gdrights.org. So using the GD Rights framework, we've estimated what we think is Europe's fair share of the climate burden, and it actually comes to a number that is maybe a little counterintuitive. It comes to reductions of 103% below its 1990 emissions. So, you know, how can it be bigger than 100%? Well, it can only be understood if you think of it being in terms of two obligations. One is to do domestic actions, but the other is to assist the developing countries with their own mitigation efforts. That translates, in terms of the international efforts, that translates into a very large number, between 150 billion and 450 billion, which is maybe between 1 and 3% of the EU's projected 2020 GDP. Now, in turning to domestic actions, the way we've addressed this is to look at a very detailed mitigation scenario of the kind of actions that can be undertaken by Europe within Europe, so not including offsetting, but the kind of actions that can be done within Europe to address climate change. So we prepared a very detailed scenario for all 27 EU countries that aims at two targets, a 40% reduction relative to 1990 values by 2020 and close to 90% by 2050. And what we find is that that, in fact, can be achieved. It will require a massive effort, but it can indeed technically be achieved through a combination of very radical efficiency improvements, the accelerated retirement of fossil fuels, and a dramatic shift towards various types of renewables, including wind, solar, wave, geothermal, and biomass-based CHP. In this particular scenario, at the request of Friends of the Earth, we've excluded certain options, including nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, and biofuels. And we haven't looked at offsetting, so we're really focusing on achieving those targets domestically within Europe. We've also looked at issues of sufficiency equity in lifestyles. So this scenario is very much a scenario of Europe continuing to grow and get richer in the future, but we have looked at a number of issues such as having a more equal Europe in the future, so there's faster growth in poorer countries, less growth in richer countries. We've also looked at the issue of lifestyle changes, so we looked at healthier diets, more leisure time, increased share of public transport. Just a couple of charts from the scenario. I haven't got time to show you in very much detail at all, but some of the key aspects are, you can see some of it here, a very radical improvements in efficiency, which does seem to be possible, and also switching to lower carbon fuels. So we're phasing out coal very rapidly. We're also phasing out oil and gas where possible, switching to CHP and renewables, but very dramatic improvements in energy efficiency. Let's skip that one. On the supply side, a very radical switch to electric generation to various types of renewables, very rapid phasing out of coal. So these things do seem to be possible. There's sufficient wind power available, there's sufficient wind potential and sufficient renewable potential to provide these kinds of energy requirements. It also seems to be possible to build the kind of renewables that you need quickly enough. It's going to require a big mobilization, but it does seem to be possible. And then finally, just in terms of cost of mitigation, we've done a kind of preliminary estimate of the costs, including the major sectors involved, and we find that the costs come to about somewhere between 2 and 3% of GDP. Which is broadly consistent with what other studies looking at sort of major transitions are talking about. So remember, to that, though, must be added the Europe's international obligations for helping developing countries do their own transition. And that also comes to a further 1 to 3% of GDP. So the costs are not small, but they're not inconceivably large either. They're somewhere between, we think, 3 to 6% of GDP. But what you've got to balance that against is the costs of inaction. We haven't looked at that specifically in this report, but the most authoritative sources in that regard is probably the Stern Review, which comes up with estimates saying the costs of not acting on climate change are likely to be at least 5% and perhaps as high as 20% of GDP. So yes, this is going to require a major mobilization, but the cost of doing something looks like it's dramatically lower than the cost of not doing something about this problem. And I'll leave it at that for now.
Respect indigenous people's rights. Respect the indigenous people's rights! Respect the indigenous people's rights! Respect the indigenous people's rights! No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No
rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
No rights!
Respect indigenous people's rights!
Respect indigenous people's rights!
From every corner of the glacier, it is melting down, which is very critical situation. 85% of drinking water for China is coming from Tibet, one. And the 40% of Asian countries' drinking water comes from Tibet. So now that if we not able to preserve it before it gets too late, then China will be creating a water crisis in the future. So during negotiation, we have requested them to raise the Tibetan glacier situation or melting situation, because Tibet is at the heart of the world, and it is the roof of the world. So that this is very important. Secondly, that Tibet's nomads have lived for millennia on the grasslands of Tibetan plateau, but are now facing a human rights and climate crisis. This is very critical, because China's policy of forcing tens of thousands of our nomads into permanent exile in their own homeland and severely restricting the movement of most of the remaining nomads are essential to sustaining the long-term health of the ecosystem and water resources that China so desperately depends on. So how they are doing this? Because the nomad people are eco-friendly people. They know how to preserve the pasture land. And this is the nomad people that till now this has been preserved. Till now that we can see the very beautiful landscape of the Tibet nomad places. This is due to that nomad people have preserved them. They are very good in preserving their own pasture land, because they are the doctor. Because they don't have any scientific, they are not well known of scientific terms and all these like carbon dioxide and atmosphere and all this. But they are more than that. So they don't know how to say what is carbon dioxide, but they are very, by natural wisdom, they have a very natural eco-friend. And we have, if we don't have right to live with our own lifestyle, then who we are, where we are.
We are here because our climate, our lives are very political realities. And the way that people and movements throughout the world can speak out is in the streets, it's demonstrating, it is resisting, it is calling attention of the world to indeed what are the impacts of very political action. And so we think that not only is the expertise in our communities that indeed have been resisting the onslaught of what is now producing a climate crisis for many, many centuries and are going to continue to do that, these are the people, these are the movements that are on the front line of the negotiations. They're negotiating every day for their lives with the corporations that are walking off and sitting very clearly and very easily and very technically, apparently, here in the negotiations. So if people can't get into the negotiations, and indeed we are being kept out, today we are being limited in our numbers, tomorrow there's even going to be fewer, and 2 days from now you will hardly see an NGO in this building. That means that people are being kept out. The only place we can express ourselves on what is an issue of our lives and our death is right there. It's on the streets. So that's why we're going to go about the process of reclaiming power tomorrow, and we're going to continue after Copenhagen. This is a political discussion, and it means that everyone in the North and in the South has to speak out. Now is the time. Our lives are at stake. The life of Mother Earth is at stake. We can join in together, or we can all lose in the process.
They call it the Fossil Award, and my government, Canada, has won, and I'm proud of that. They deserve to win. The United States has won a few times. The European Union has won, but it's always just the governments. The corporations and the lobbyists don't win. So what this award is about is the fact that it's time to out the people behind the politicians. Our job is to follow the money. We don't win this battle without talking about power and without talking about money. So, these pressures that we're not supposed to talk about in the Bella Center are why the negotiations have fallen apart, and why really the only hope at this point for a deal is if the U.S. and Europe successfully twist the arms of the developing countries enough to force them to sign a deal that is against their interests. And we need to say very clearly that it's better to have no deal at all than to have a bad deal like that. We'll hold out a little longer. So that's where the real power is, right? I mean, we know that these are the lobbyists that have bought off the U.S. Congress, and why really this conference failed before it even began, because we were all fed this line that there's no way the U.S. Congress will pass serious climate legislation, which means that Obama can't come here with a real offer. Why? Because they are bought and paid for by the corporations that you just heard about just now.
Almost everyone, it seems, has acquiesced to the lowest common denominator offered by rich countries. At around 9 a.m. this morning, the talks were adjourned as Ed Miliband and others pursue their charge to find a way around the blocking of several countries in order to finally force this deal through. But let's be clear, this is a deal that would not be grounded in science and will likely lead to runaway climate change. It kills the Kyoto Protocol and the legally binding commitment it makes on all rich nations except the United States. And although it says that funds of $100 billion per year will be raised, it's not clear how much of this is new money, how much of this is coming from existing development aid budgets, but it is likely that the bulk of it will come from the carbon markets, with all the problems that that implies. How did all the countries who had been fighting for a principled and effective deal based on science and justice come to abandon everything they had fought so long and hard for? Under pressure to break the deadlock of the talks in order to get a deal, poor and vulnerable countries have given away everything, while rich countries have hardly moved an inch, and some of them have moved backwards. Right now, it's not clear how the impasse at these talks will be resolved, or if it will be resolved. But as the social movements outside these talks have been saying long in advance of the talks, citizens will have to continue to take matters into their own hands.
It is better for us to act than to talk. It's better for us to choose action over inaction, the future over the past. And with courage and faith, I believe that we can meet our responsibilities to our people and the future of our planet.
I went to the shop to buy some gas. I said to the shopkeeper, "Where do you get your gas?" He said, "What you're talking about?" I said, "Is it yours?" He said, "Of course it is. Do you want some?" I said, "Where do you get your gas from?" He said, "I get it from the gas company." I said, "Where do the gas company get their gas from?" He said, "Are you taking the piss?" I said, "No. I just want to know where all this gas comes from." He said, "They get it out the ground." I said, "Who said they could take it out the ground?" I said, "Who said they could take it out the ground?" I said, "Who said they could take it out the ground?" He said, "I heard you the first time, mate. And if you're not buying any gas, then maybe you better get out. I said you'd be chopping down trees in the park next. and selling them as firewood. He said, that's not a bad idea, but don't bring your problems into my shop. I said, it's not my problem, it's my kid's problem. He said, you better leave before somebody gets hurt. I said, violence might make you feel better in the short term, but you gotta start looking at the bigger picture. He took a swipe at me, and I ducked out the shop and crossed over the road to go and have a word with the fishmonger.